through the world. The court will now resume the docket, and the last case for argument today is number 033681, the United States against Henningsen.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dennis Coffey, and I appear on behalf of Mr. Henningsen, who is the appellant. Mr. Henningsen was originally indicted in the Eastern District of Wisconsin in a 5-count indictment. The first count alleged an extortion. The last 4 counts involved mail fraud allegations. Mr. Henningsen was found not guilty of the extortion count, but was found guilty of the mail fraud count. On this appeal, we are basically raising issues with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence as they relate to the first, counts 2 through 5 of the indictment, and also certain sentencing issues.
forgive me, Mr. Coffey, but if we remanded for resentencing under Blakely and Booker, what would the new sentencing range be?
Well, in addressing, not knowing how to address sentencing issues this morning exactly, I would advise the court that the issues that have been raised on this appeal relate basically to an amount of loss, which in the pre-sentence investigation would account for 12 base offense level points. 4 points were added for number of victims involved, and there are 2 points added for an obstruction matter. That would mean that out of the 22 points upon which the sentence was originally based, you would be looking at potentially 18 of those points being in play. Without the obstruction and without...
By being in play, you mean they would be considered by the trial court when they pass the sentence?
If the guidelines do not apply, those specific findings which we are challenging on this appeal would not theoretically be attributable to Mr. Henningsen.
So when you say it's in play, you mean it's out of play?
Yes. For the immediate time, yes. With the confusion about guidelines in existence as it is at the moment, I would like first to address the question of the sufficiency of the evidence. Mr. Henningsen was an alderman in the city of Milwaukee for an extended period of time. He had run multiple campaigns. He had a campaign account, if you will. There were 4 individuals who were identified by the government as the subject matter, if you will, of the counts. A Mr. Chitko, a Mr. Rajani, a Mr. Monat, and then there was a hybrid, if you will. There was an architect in Mr. Epstein, who went out and gathered contributions from other individuals so that it wasn't just Mr. Epstein's contribution, but rather a collection of funds received from various members of a firm he was involved with. In terms of the false representations, I would submit that what the record establishes is that there are some pre-printed contribution envelopes, if you will. They contain what is political language, that is, elect me, for a variety of reasons. The difficulty I have with the government's having indicted Mr. Henningsen and with the convictions in those 4 counts is that the assault gun ban is supposed to expire at midnight tonight. If one of the presidential candidates goes out and says, I will get another assault ban act passed, and then never takes any step whatsoever to do that, does that constitute a false representation? Because what Mr. Henningsen said was, I'm going to run for election. I need your assistance. He didn't promise anyone anything. It's my personal opinion. It's not...
How do we deal with the handing out of the envelope and the stating, you know, don't send anything in until after this vote goes down.
Well,
how do we handle that?
I think the interesting thing about that one particular matter, and that's Mr. Chitko's
right.
contribution, if you believe the government's theory when this case started, and if you believe what Mr. Chitko says, he wasn't making a contribution at all. He wasn't under any misapprehension whatsoever. What he was doing, he was bribing Mr. Henningsen. The jury disregarded, they found him not guilty of that. But the fact is, that's not a false representation in Mr. Chitko's mind. And if you take the government's posture, there's no false implication in what is said to Mr. Chitko. So there's no false representation. If you take what Mr. Henningsen and Chitko are supposedly involved in, it's you don't contribute till after the vote because then it looks like I'm clean. It has nothing to do with a scheme to obtain contributions and then use them for your own personal expenses. In terms of Mr. Monat, there are no representations, I mean, there are no oral representations made to any of these persons about what they're going to get, and clearly nobody could be, no one would be entitled to expect I'm going to get based upon a political contribution. The government's argument, and much of its evidence, related to Mr. Henningsen's failure to comply with some state regulation laws involving the reporting of campaign expenditures, not the contribution. Even in those instances where the government says he got a check for $375, cashed it, and he took $201.75, went in the bank account. Even in those instances, the evidence establishes the contributions are reported on the form. The expenditures, in all cases, are not. That, I submit, is perhaps an election law violation in the state of Wisconsin, but it does not, in and of itself, establish that when Mr. Henningsen went out and solicited contributions to run for alderman, he intended to defraud others. It's one of those things that there are representations made in the course of political campaigns. People believe them or don't believe them. Oftentimes, people contribute to both sides of the fight because what they're looking for is access.
What they don't contemplate is the money they're giving for political contributions go to support the private life of the person receiving it.
And I would be inclined to agree with the court with your statement. The problem or the difficulty I have with it is that there was evidence presented, and this goes to Mr. Henningsen's intent. There is clear evidence that he did make significant loans over the course of years to his campaign. We had a person who was versed in campaign law in Wisconsin come in and testify that he's entitled to recoup those funds. Even Mr. Rajani,
he presented the evidence to the jury that he had made significant contributions.
Yes.
And they rejected it.
There was evidence of approximately $40,000.
They rejected it.
The jury rejected it, yes.
There you go.
Yes. So that it's our position that the government did not make out its case with respect to all of these counts because there are no false representations made. There clearly isn't one made to Mr. Chitko. There's no representation made to Monat. There's not even evidence as to how he got the envelope. And with respect to Rajani, he wanted to talk to Henningsen about his health care business. No solicit, I mean, other than for handing him the envelope, there's nothing in the record to say a representation is made. With respect to the sentencing issue, there is a loss determined by the judge of $31,200-some. Assuming the guidelines apply, we are talking about a difference of $1,200 in order to get under the $30,000 threshold, which causes another two-level increase. At page 18 of the sentencing transcript, Judge Stattmiller, in considering just one $880 item, which is a garage door, I'm sorry, a security system, said that's a close question. So that we certainly aren't talking about beyond a reasonable doubt is the determining level in that one. With respect to number of victims, the court in essence found that everybody who contributed was a victim. even though they weren't looking for restitution, they weren't complaining, they weren't doing anything. And the mail fraud statute doesn't require that you have any victims at all. So the judge is determining an amount that's based upon no real hard evidence in the record. With respect to the obstruction matter, the judge says, well, the jury rejected the loan repayment defense. The jury accepted Mr. Henningsen's testimony. I didn't extort money from anybody. But the court did not make the specific requirement, the specific findings required by this court in its decision on perjury determinations with respect to obstruction.
Thank you, Mr. Cole.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Mel Johnson. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney from Milwaukee, and I represent the United States in this appeal.
Before you even begin, could I just ask you this?
Sure.
If we find that Mr. Henningsen preserved the Blakely issue, would the government still oppose his motion for stay of sentence and bail pending appeal?
Yes. I wouldn't just say either preserved or not preserved. There's, you know, sort of different degrees of preservation, ranging from outright waiver to possible forfeiture to situations where the, which I would say we have here, where the issue is belatedly raised.
Well, but you know, you faulted them for not raising the issue before the district court, and your argument is that the plain error standard applies.
That's true.
Applied.
That's true, and that continues to be our position. Because the issue was not raised below. It was not raised in the original brief to this court or in any supplementary briefing. It was not even alluded to until, I think it was September 1st was the date of the motion for bail pending appeal in this case. And the...
Well, he did challenge the sufficiency of the court's findings.
True,
and
but...
We could find... that he preserved the issue adequately, and that's what I'm asking.
I don't think so, because there's a difference between saying the judge did not have a sufficient basis for the judge's findings and saying, pursuant to Blakely, that the judge was not constitutionally authorized to even make the findings or make the determination. And while it is true that maybe that issue wasn't as obvious as it is now before Blakely, it has been raised before. It's not a unique issue, and as long ago as 1998, the U.S. Supreme Court, in the Edwards case, held that judges were constitutionally authorized to make such determinations. So that issue could have been raised earlier. It wasn't. As a result of that, it would be our position, as explained in a little more detail in the response to the motion for bail pending appeal, that can result in a finding of error only if this court is able to find plain error. If you want me to address that further, I'll be happy to. Otherwise, I'll allude to Mr. Coffey's argument about sufficiency of the evidence.
Well, I think I have your view.
All right. First of all, I'd like to correct, I think, a slight misstatement by Mr. Coffey. I looked back in my notes when he was asked about the sentencing range and how many points were in play here. The overall offense level ended up for Mr. Henningsen at 22. 12 points of those 22 were in dispute. There were 6 points for amount of loss, 4 points for number of victims, and 2 points for obstruction of justice. Now, Mr. Coffey has argued that the evidence was insufficient to support Mr. Henningsen's convictions. He has argued, I think perhaps a little more explicitly in the brief and somewhat today orally, that, well, the contributors here were not really defrauded. I mean, the essence of this fraud case, like any fraud case, is you obtain money from someone by representing what you're going to do with it while you're doing something else and you know you're doing something else with that money. Well, Mr. Coffey argues that, well, the contributors got what they were promised. Mr. Henningsen did intend to run for re-election, and therefore the fact that he used the money for something else having nothing to do with re-election really didn't mean that they're defrauded. That argument really doesn't make any sense. When a person contributes money to a political candidate for the purpose of getting that candidate reelected. They're not, in effect, bribing the candidate. They're not, in effect, saying, well, if I give you $250, will you run? No. They're giving them money to spend on the campaign. That's what these contributors did, and that's what Mr. Henningsen didn't do. That is, the evidence is clear that he took the money, which was contributed during the scheme period, and used it for personal expenditures. There's a great deal of evidence proving that the defendant solicited and obtained large amounts of campaign contributions by representing that they would be used to get him reelected. That was the clear message on the envelopes which were used to mail in the contributions. The testimony of Mr. Rajani was to the effect that he met Alderman Henningsen at a fundraiser for another candidate, a different alderman in Milwaukee, and that Mr. Henningsen asked him to make contributions to his campaign. Mr. Epstein, whose testimony was brought in by stipulation, stated by way of stipulation that Mr. Henningsen told him he wanted to grow a big war chest in order to scare off competitors. What Mr. Henningsen did was appear to establish a big war chest because he reported ever-growing amounts of money in his campaign fund, when in fact there was next to no money in that campaign fund, because the evidence shows that he actually spent more on personal purposes during the scheme period from January of 2001 through July of 2002 than he received in contributions. If you look at the exhibits, which are his campaign disclosure reports for that period, they reflect that he received contributions during that time period of a little more than $29,000. The evidence reflects that he actually spent $31,395 on what the court found, appropriately, were personal expenditures. And that's the essence, as I said before, of any fraud scheme. You obtain money from people by stating that you're going to do a certain thing with that money while you know that you're doing something else with the money. The case is filled with falsehoods by the defendant to carry out the scheme. There's the false representations to contributors. There's the false campaign disclosure reports where he consistently reported that he had amounts of money in his campaign account much larger than he actually had. There's the false notations on the memo lines of various checks. You'll recall that the evidence showed that there were a lot of the money was taken by Alderman Henningsen through the checks to cash, which he wrote against his campaign account. Then on various occasions, he wrote in the initials of various people that were working on his campaign, implying that money was being used to pay those people, which Mr. Henningsen admitted on the stand during the trial was false. He claimed that he did it to mislead his wife, not to mislead contributors or mislead investigators, but in any event, he made those false notations. The defendant offered his loan theory, but that was rejected by the jury beyond a reasonable doubt for very good reason. First of all, there was no documentation of any such loans. The testimony was that the FBI obtained, I think through grand jury subpoena, all of Mr. Henningsen's campaign records. There were documentations of various loans to and from Mr. Henningsen, but there was no documentation which came close to supporting the loans that he alleged he had made to his campaign during his testimony. Similarly, there was no reporting of any loans on any of the campaign disclosure reports. Mr. Henningsen was a veteran politician. He had been a county supervisor for years. He had been a Milwaukee alderman for many years, had filed many of these reports, and his reports do at times reflect reports of loans to or from the campaign. He had done that before, but none of the loans that he alleged during his testimony were reported in any campaign disclosure reports. The notion that the money he took was just reimbursement to himself for loans he had previously made to his campaign was also pretty thoroughly debunked by the amount of money in his campaign account. If you were making loans to your campaign account that for some reason you weren't reporting, the amount in that account would exceed the amount that you reported. However, the exact opposite was true for Mr. Henningsen. The report, when compared to the bank records, which were also presented as evidence during the trial, consistently reflect that Mr. Henningsen very consistently reported much more money in his campaign account than was actually there, again thoroughly debunking the notion that somehow this $31,000 was repayment for him. The standard for sufficiency of the evidence is a very difficult one for a defendant to meet. It's very clear that under this state of the evidence, Mr. Henningsen's unable to meet it. I see that my time is almost up. If you have any questions about any other aspects of the case, I'd be happy to address them. Otherwise, I'm close to the end.
Can you tell me if we remanded for resentencing under Blakely and Booker, what the new sentencing range would be?
Well, I guess I really can't, only because Judge Stadmiller has taken the position that he's essentially not doing sentencing until the Supreme Court decides Booker and Fanfan, and so I don't expect that there'd even be a sentencing hearing scheduled before the Supreme Court decided those cases. And unless and until the Supreme Court tells us how these matters are supposed to be handled, because there's, you know, several different ways this could come out,
mm-hmm.
I'd really be only guessing if I answered your question.
Yeah.
In other words, we could have, for example, we could have to convene a sentencing jury, and you know,
how could you do that? Don't get involved in that one. That's
I'm just putting that as one of the many
possibilities.
Sentencing
jury, they tell them what? Somebody said something that you ought to think about, or what?
Well,
mull that over someplace else. Cause it's not part of this case.
No.
Fair enough. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Johnson.
You.
And I believe your time had expired, Mr. Coffey. So both you and Mr. Johnson have the thanks of the court for, and court, that, and the court will take the case under advisement. The call of the day is complete, so the court will rise until tomorrow at 9:30.